Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of GTI Insights, the Global Taiwan Institute's policy podcast. My name is Sophia Knight. I'm a research intern here with the GTI and your guest host for this episode.
And I'm Marshall Reed, a research assistant at GTI.
Today, we're delighted to be joined by Jesse Lau, a freelance journalist and editor-in-chief at New Voices. We will be discussing transnational solidarity and social movements in the Asia-Pacific. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us today, Jesse. To begin our conversation, could you please tell us a little bit about your work with New Voices? What was your motivation for founding an online publication which centers women and minorities working on the subject of China?
Sure. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be speaking with GTI Insights on a topic so close to my heart, especially. So I'm a freelance journalist from Hong Kong. I am a board member and editor at New Voices, which is an international collective that aims to support women working on China subjects, but also to amplify minority voices and gender minorities on the topic of Greater China. And this New Voices really began as a reaction to the lack of spaces for women's voices in the industry and the China watching world. And really, we wanted to have the space and create these different platforms to be able to have these discussions on things that weren't really covered by mainstream media. It began with, we had an expert directory of female experts on China, and it sort of blossomed into this bigger organization. We have board members in different parts of the world, from our chair and founder, Joanna, in Canada. I'm in London, members in Australia. We now have a podcast with SubChina News, and we also have a digital magazine called New Stories, which I edit. And we try to provide a space for people to connect and talk about issues related to gender and feminism.
Well, that's really interesting. I mean, like you said there, these are not issues that are limited to a single country. I mean, you've got people all over the world, and these are issues, whether it's women's issues, feminism, or LGBTQ issues, that really transcend national boundaries. And I think you touch on that a lot in your writings, both in New Voices and elsewhere. And I was drawn to the concept that you touch on a lot, which is transnational solidarity. So when you talk about that, what exactly do you mean, and how does it kind of inform your view of social movements such as the Hong Kong democracy movement, feminist movements, LGBTQ movements? Just love to hear a little bit more about that.
For sure. I think it's something that is increasingly important to think about at this stage. I mean, what is transnational solidarity? What does transnational solidarity look like? For me, I kind of see it as pretty much the values that connect us as human beings across borders, that cut across these colonialist, capitalist, patriarchal divisions that divide us in the world. So looking at how, you know, different movements, social movements in different parts of the world, although they have a very local context, how they have, you know, many, many parallels and shared values that can be exported, and lessons that can be learned in different communities, and how that really connects and inspires different activists across the world. And I think thinking about the different social movements that have cropped up in recent years, not just in Greater China, but also in Asia as a region, and also globally. I mean, if you look at Black Lives Matter as well, and just so many different movements worldwide. I think looking at it from a transnational solidarity perspective is really important, because it shows that these different movements and these struggles are not isolated, didn't happen in a vacuum. I mean, there is so much of these movements are influenced by the structures that of oppression. That is something that we have to grapple with globally. And I really believe that we need to have global responses to these problems. And so for me, it's been really a learning experience to look at different social movements across the world, to write about them, to draw connections between them, and really help inform my understanding of how these kind of activism and advocacy struggles kind of take place and the trajectory that they take as well.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you that these kind of global connections are so important. And something recently that's been developing is this movement, Stop Asian Hate. So of course, the context is particular to communities in the Asian diaspora across Europe and the US who have been the target of violence as a result of the pandemic and kind of racist aggression resulting from that. And we've seen a series of rallies, not just held in these countries, but actually around the world. There was one such instance in Taipei. And I wanted to ask you, in this specific instance, what do you think the value of transnational solidarity can be when responding to specific instances of discrimination in the context of these oppressive structures that you've talked about that are global?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, I guess, this framing of the recent spike in violence against Southeast and East Asians, in particularly Western countries, because myself, like, I'm not part of the diaspora community. I was born and raised in Hong Kong, and I moved to California when I was 16. And then I've also lived in Beijing and London, studying and working as a journalist. And to me, I mean, racism against people of Asian descent is something that I've experienced everywhere across the world and in every context and every place I've lived in, including my home. I mean, this is an issue that, you know, racism doesn't just occur in these white societies. I mean, I've been subjected to racist attacks even in China, in Hong Kong, in Taiwan. And so it's really a, you know, a structural problem that transcends borders and affects people of Asian descent everywhere. So I think transnational solidarity and having transnational response to this is really important, because it kind of helps us take power and agency over this issue. And what I mean by that is that I think traditionally in a lot of places like the US, the UK, where there's a model minority kind of system at play when it comes to Asian communities, there's been this perception that Asians are not radical, they don't advocate, don't want to rock the boat, and there's a culture of like assimilationism towards like whiteness that protects the communities. And that's very much true. But there's, you know, there's always been a long history of anti-colonialist, anti-racist struggles within these Asian communities in the West. And I think it's been really great to see a resurgence of this, to see new activists and you know, working with activists from older generations working on issues of race, coming up and creating new platforms and new ways to fight back. Because especially one of the reasons why I think visibility of this issue is really important, and a lot more people are able to recognize that there is violence, right, against these communities. But on the flip side of that, visibility also makes these communities a lot more vulnerable. And you can see that with Black communities and the history of how that has played out in Black communities, where heightened visibility has led to, you know, like stereotypes of Black people as dangerous or as victims. And you can definitely see that in the way that the media is reporting crimes against violence against Asians. And you can see those trends being perpetuated. And so by creating solidarities and creating these spaces for people to have agency and push back and just have Asian voices centered in this discussion is really important for fighting and pushing back against that.
Definitely. Actually, I wanted to pick up on something you mentioned there, because there was a piece you wrote, I think about a year ago, where you talked about solidarity between the Hong Kong democracy movement and the Black Lives Matter protests. And I was just wondering if you could elaborate a little bit that for our listeners, how these basis of maybe shared oppressions, shared struggle can form collaboration going forwards and learning from one another.
Yeah, I wrote this story for The Nation on how the US-China rivalry is thwarting solidarities between Hong Kong protesters and Black Lives Matter protesters. And it's interesting because these movements seem very different, on the get-go when you first look at these issues. And of course, they're very localized and have their very specific to their context. But at the end of the day, I mean, you have these shared values of advocating for, you know, democratic values of, you know, the right to protest. And also, I think one of the biggest themes that connect the two movements is anti-police violence and anti-state violence. And so I think Hong Kong protesters had a lot to learn from Black activists who have been working on issues of like abolition and like protesting state violence and calling for disbanding the police and all these things. And you can see these sorts of ideas being echoed in the Hong Kong movement. And I think with Black Lives Matter as well, you can see a lot of interest in seeing, you know, the tactics that Hong Kong protesters have used in protests in Hong Kong. So, you know, beyond even just sharing, I guess, motifs like using umbrellas, right? And then like the yellow hard hats and these kind of symbolized imageries that are inspiring activists for both these movements. I think there is also tangible sharing of resources. I've seen events held by grassroots organizations that foster dialogue between these activists. And one other thing that is important is also looking at the way labor is played out in these movements. So how labor is a big part of the Hong Kong protest movement. And that's also a big part of the way activism, you know, is conducted in Black Lives Matter movement. So there's lots of connections to be drawn there.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's fascinating. To change direction slightly to another group that really has experienced a lot of challenges throughout East Asia and Greater China, which is the LGBTQ movement. And I think it was really a momentous moment in 2019 when same-sex marriage was legalized in Taiwan. And I think it was definitely seemed like a large victory both for the movement in Taiwan and for movements across East Asia. So now as LGBTQ campaigners focus on the right of same-sex couples to adopt children in Taiwan, have you seen from your vantage point, you know, the impact of this movement across the Asia Pacific? Have you seen similar movements in other countries, whether it's Hong Kong, Japan, China, and really in particular, have you seen similar movements in Greater China?
I think overall, broadly speaking, there has been an increase in gender awareness across Greater China and also regionally in Asia. I mean, I'm not sure if I can speak to any direct links between activists. I mean, they're very well, maybe, but I think it's more broad than that. I mean, I think the fact that Taiwan is the first in Asia to legalize same-sex marriage is a very significant and landmark step in promoting progressive values across the region. It definitely has an impact regionally because other states can point to that and as a standard, as a bar. So I think it's very crucial and very important. What's been interesting to me is that as someone who is from Hong Kong and focuses a lot on Hong Kong issues, I actually think Hong Kong's LGBT movement has lagged behind both Taiwan and mainland China. And I that's very fascinating to me because, in China, you can see that although, you know, it's still very taboo to talk about LGBT issues. There has been some movement legally, for example, issues of like guardianship appointments, which is this mechanism that gives the freedom for someone to appoint their own guardian, which has been a way to kind of give more rights to same-sex couples. And then you see these changes happening in Taiwan. But Hong Kong has very much fallen behind, I think, when it comes to like legal battles. And recently I wrote this story looking at a couple of legal challenges being launched by LGBT activists and people in the community against the Hong Kong government to advocate for rights. And in Hong Kong, unfortunately, it's a system in which people have to use the judicial review and launch legal cases against the government to advocate for rights, which is both very traumatic for these individuals, financially costly, but also just, the government then uses taxpayer money to kind of fight against, people in this case. And so it's kind of a lose-lose situation, as one activist pointed out to me. So I think, if you look at what's happening in Taiwan and also the movement in mainland China, I think they provide a sort of direction for people in Hong Kong to kind of look at and see like, okay, like how is Taiwan, how is mainland China, grappling with rights for same-sex couples. And I think there's a lot of room to learn from what's happening in different parts of Greater China. So I think it's definitely very significant that Taiwan is taking these steps to have more legal protections for this very vulnerable community.
To build off of that point, feminist movements are often linked to other social movements, and you find this same capacity for groups to inspire groups in other countries to advance similar agendas. And I was wondering, have you seen kind of Taiwan's progress in feminist movements, kind of inspiring similar movements in other parts of Asia, or this kind of, how have you seen feminism develop in Greater China in this way?
Yeah, I think feminism or gender equality has been an issue that has been very vocally discussed in the Taiwan context recently. I mean, I think since Tsai Ing-wen became the first woman president with a record, what is it, like over 50% of the vote in re-election, mm-hmm. and then having women being elected to over 40% of seats across the legislative body, which is, I think, the highest proportion in Asia, these are very significant milestones, not just for the Greater China region, but just Asia regionally as well. And so it's very, you know, it's very positive and it's great. I think Tsai Ing-wen has also spoken out against misogyny and advocating for gender equality, which is great to see. But I mean, I've been speaking to some scholars and activists working on Taiwan issues. And it's interesting because they also point out to me that there's still so much to be done in Taiwan because there is still, you know, a lot of sexual discrimination and like harassment that occurs. And a lot of people speak about Taiwan still having this culture of silence when it comes to sexual harassment, which is why you can see that there was no very radical Me Too movement, perhaps in comparison to mainland China. So there's definitely still a lot of work to be done. What I found quite interesting is that there's a lot of similarities between the struggles that activists seem to face in Taiwan and how activists in the feminist sphere face in Hong Kong. And I think it's because some of the similarities I've noticed is that both in Hong Kong and Taiwan, there is perhaps a lot of discourse on gender equality that perpetuate this idea that gender equality is like kind of, it's already achieved in these societies, or that it's, you know, women in Taiwan or Hong Kong are, you know, much more progressive or equal compared to women in mainland China or women in other parts of Southeast Asia and East Asia. And this can be quite damaging and quite difficult to advocate for rights because it's difficult to kind of show people that this is still something that needs to be discussed. But I think it's something that is changing and has changed with the Hong Kong protests when, you know, sexual assault and harassment and sexual violence in particular have been something that has been thrown into the public spotlight from the 2019 protests. And I think there's a lot of lessons that, you know, Hong Kong and Taiwan can learn from activists in mainland China, and also that, you know, Hong Kong can learn from the way that Taiwan has grappled with feminism as well. So I think there is a lot of, I also want to say that the issue of feminism is one that I look at from an intersectional perspective. And so, you know, feminism is something that cuts across so many different issues, including migration and racism. So it's relevant to looking at these issues in Taiwan, for example, indigenous rights or cross-strait families in Taiwan. I mean, these are all issues that you can look at from a feminist perspective. And so to me, the idea of looking at feminism with transnational solidarity and a potential for change across these different issues, I think is really powerful. And I think is you definitely see this happening with lots more discussions on social media and people sharing ideas and kind of trying to grapple with these issues within the Greater China region.
Sure. And I'd like to single out something you said there, that, you know, these movements are not finished. These are not, we haven't, even in places like Taiwan that have made progress, there's still a long way to go for all of these movements. There's still a huge amount of gains that could be made. So I'd like to look ahead a little bit. I know this is always difficult, but how can these movements, whether it's the feminist movement, LGBTQ movements, really all of these social movements, how can they strengthen their transnational solidarity in Greater China going forward? What can they do to better achieve their goals going forward? And always importantly, you know, how can they translate these movements into meaningful policy changes in their respective countries?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I mean, I think it's really important right now to focus on the grassroots nature of social movements. And you definitely see a lot of grassroots efforts by feminist activists and gender activists as kind of the catalyst for change in many places. And so, for example, like looking at within China, the feminist movement, you can see how gender activists and feminist activists in China have successfully been able to translate their activism into like meaningful policy changes, right? You have the domestic violence law that took effect in 2016. And last year, you had China passing its first civil code, which expanded the definition of sexual harassment and recognized it as a legal offense for the first time. And so although it's still largely symbolic and there are a lot of issues and kind of loopholes to these kind of policy changes, at least there's a sort of guideline for looking at, you know, how to grapple with these changes moving forward. And a lot of this is very much, a lot of these changes have very much been spurred by the actions of feminist activists in China and like promoting this issue as, you know, an important issue in mainstream society and mainstream discussions in China. And so I think moving forward, it's about looking at like ways to enforce, you know, these policy changes and have more like practical, tangible legal protections for women. Another one I wanted to point out was the Milk Tea Alliance, right? Where you have this movement, well, Milk Tea Alliance is this digital coalition between Taiwan, Hong Kong, Thailand, and Myanmar, where activists use milk tea as a symbol of kind of solidarity, joining activists in these different places, advocating for mostly democratic values in very like localized struggles. And so it's an example of how you have a digital coalition that's based on solidarity through social media that has spilled out onto the streets and led to like actual street protests and like tangible movements. And so that's another example of how, you know, when you have solidarity and, you know, you're inspired by activists and movements in other countries, how that can really create, I guess, like practical change and like practical actions. And you can see activists in like Thailand and Myanmar using the techniques that Hong Kong protesters have used, for example, looking at like flash mobs protests, right? Or using like encrypted messaging to be able to organize and evade authorities. And so these are kind of like, you know, tangible, I guess, fruits of like what solidarities can kind of achieve. And I think the what's moving forward, what's important is like, how do you sustain this? And how do you, you know, how do you make sure that this can grow into a larger political force in the region?
Great. We've kind of got one extra question here that we just thought we'll kind of put this in somewhere if we have time.
Sure.
So in August 2020, you published this article titled "Banning WeChat Will Destroy a Lone Bridge Between the US and China." And in this piece, you acknowledge the security concerns associated with WeChat, but you also highlighted how important this app is to many people in their daily lives. And I was wondering, looking back on this piece, how would you describe the impact of US-China relations right now on ordinary citizens? And do you think connections can be built and maintained amidst this current geopolitical rivalry that seems to be dragging everyone into it?
Yeah, first of all, thank you for reading my piece. And thank you for this question, which I think is very relevant. I mean, gosh, I'm so worried. I think all China watchers are right now, right? And I'm just very concerned about the escalating situation. And it's interesting because, I mean, the Biden administration has said it would kind of, or like has signaled it would take a deliberative approach to kind of evaluate all the China-related actions that Trump took in office. But it has also kind of signaled it would maintain a tough stance towards China, especially in terms of looking at like making sure that Beijing can't obtain American technology and data that could threaten US national security. And so, you know, when you look at this dynamic and looking at the recent escalations, like sanctions, the sanction showdown between China and different Western countries over Xinjiang, issues over Hong Kong, you know, it's a climate that's becoming increasingly hostile. And it has a very direct impact on Chinese and not just Chinese, but people of East and Southeast Asian descent. And you can see this manifested in the violence and violent attacks that we spoke about earlier on this podcast. And, you know, there was always racism, but in many ways, this geopolitical tension has fueled these violent incidents and racist attacks. And so it's definitely affecting people everywhere across the globe. And it's interesting in terms of looking at these technologies and WeChat, because it's like in my article, I interviewed a lot of people who were very, very against WeChat. And like, it is a tool for, you know, political disinformation and fake news. And I, you know, I understand a lot of these threats. But on the flip side, you know, a lot of human rights activists, journalists, ordinary citizens use this to maintain a connection to people within China. It's one of the few kind of avenues for connection between China and the external world as well. And so I think from that article, a lot of experts kind of spoke about how there is definitely a need for regulation and a need to address these risks, but it needs to be done in a way that's a lot more scrutinized, with a lot more scrutiny, and done in a way that's a lot more careful, and weighing like all of these different considerations. And so another point that I want to bring up is that, I mean, it's been widely reported that Chinese youth in particular are becoming, or seem to become, more nationalistic in recent years. And there is a lot more, less interest in kind of like international collaborations, or like you see more Chinese students who have studied overseas choosing to return to China. And so you definitely have this narrative kind of being spoken about and discussed in media. And I think this is quite damaging the recent news is looking at these narrowing of spaces for dialogue, because I think these are really important opportunities for us to be able to engage with ordinary citizens in China. And so that's very, very worrying for me. But on the other side, you know, looking at recently the app Clubhouse, you know, before that was banned in China, there were lots of discussions on them between people outside of China and people in China on very contentious issues, like, you know, Xinjiang, Taiwan, and Hong Kong, just being some of them. I mean, I think like those types of conversations have really shown that there is still appetite for dialogue and this interest in cross-cultural understanding. And so when there are spaces for these exchanges to occur, you know, there's still productive and constructive dialogue that can happen. And so I think moving forward, we really need to strengthen these kinds of spaces and strengthen grassroots efforts to allow for this, because I think this is the most important thing to stop this, I guess, ordinary Chinese people being caught up in this geopolitical rivalry, which likes to paint Chinese people as the Chinese Communist Party. And that's a very damaging ideology to perpetuate.
Definitely. And that's something I have really appreciated about reading your work, is this ability to encompass what's human in these stories and maintain that nuance. I really have enjoyed your work for that. And thank you so much for joining us. I feel like we've explored some really important and really underappreciated issues today. And thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us. Would you like to let our audience know where they can find out more about your work?
Sure. Thank you so much for having me. You can find my work on my website, which is www.laujessie.com, LAUJESSIE.com. And you can check out our work at New Voices at newvoices.com, which is NUVOICES.com. And we're also on social media. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Yeah, it was really great to have this discussion. Thank you so much for inviting me.
So thank you to all of our listeners for joining us for another episode of GTI Insights. Thank you also to the wonderful staff and interns at the GTI for all their help with every step of producing this podcast. Finally, thank you to Joe Ross and his band Roraima for providing our theme music. If you're interested in learning more about the Global Taiwan Institute, please visit our website at globaltaiwan.org. where you can find information about our fortnightly publication, The Global Taiwan Brief, as well as our frequent public seminars. You can also listen to more episodes of GTI Insights on all of the major podcasting services, as well as on our website's podcast page. Until next time, this has been GTI Insights.